It is so hard to believe that it has been 42 years since the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
That, of course, was the great CBS newsman, Walter Cronkite. I remember that distinct scene. I remember him taking his glasses off. I remember him getting choked up. I was 13 years old, and I'm sure many of you who were born during that era, you remember exactly where you were on the day that John F. Kennedy was killed on November 22nd, 1963. Tonight on Coast to Coast, as we continue to look into this tragedy, this assassination, three separate guests throughout the evening, each one with their own views, their own theories into what they believe happened. Many of them have studied this for a number of years. In a moment, our guest will be the author of Ultimate Sacrifice, Lamar Waldron, on Coast to Coast AM. Lamar Waldron's groundbreaking research on JFK has been cited in media outlets ranging from Vanity Fair and The New Republic to the History Channel and USA Today. His work has been acknowledged by authors such as Anthony Summers, Gus Russo, historians like Dr. John Newman and John Davis, and former government investigators Gaten Fonzi and FBI veteran William Turner. Waldron received both undergraduate and graduate degrees from Georgia State University. He lives in Atlanta. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Lamar, welcome. And the work into this book, Ultimate Sacrifice, is probably one of the most extensive I have ever seen. How many years did it take?
17 years. It started during the 25th anniversary back in 1988.
I bet you remember, too, where you were in 1963.
Oh, certainly. I was in school, and the teacher comes in and tells the class to be quiet, and then it was just that TV coverage, not just that day, but all weekend. And I have a confession to make. I was pretending to be sick so I could stay home from going to church on Sunday, so I could watch cartoons. And then right in the middle of my cartoons, the news breaks in with the transfer of Oswald, and I was actually home alone at that time. Yeah, just for a while, and so as a child, got to watch Ruby shooting Oswald, and just didn't know what to do. So I call my parents at church. I mean, I knew this wasn't a real, this wasn't the Untouchables. So yeah, it made quite an impression on me.
I was in school too at the time. Our English teacher came in and told us she was just sobbing, Lamar, and we really didn't understand why was she crying so much. For a 13-year-old, it really didn't register just how horrible, how significant all of this was. And I, like you, on the day Oswald was shot, I have a picture up in my office in Los Angeles of Ike Pappas from CBS, right, standing right there during that shooting. But we were out playing street hockey. We weren't, as 13-year-olds, we weren't glued to the television set. Our parents were doing that. And yet, I truly believe, and you've got a phenomenal theory here that we're going to get into, since that horrible assassination, I think we've lost something in this country, and I don't think we've ever replaced it. And it just feels as if part of your gut has been removed. Do you have that feeling?
Sure, but I do think we're coming much closer to being able to come grips with that, because as the book shows, just how much has been kept secret, how much is still secret, and how much that legacy of secrecy has continued to impact American lives and U.S. history, and I think we are now on the verge of finally getting rid of that and being able to explain to people, this is exactly what happened, this is why it was covered up, here's what's still secret, and here's maybe a little bit that needs to stay secret a bit longer.
When someone gets assassinated, it's either done by a madman who's simply insane, wants a little notoriety for themselves, like the killer of John Lennon, or there's a conspiracy, there's an event, there's a reason why they want this individual removed from power, from office. Let's go back just a little bit. John Kennedy was not a really loved man by some of the people around him, was he?
Sure. Well, he was a very interesting individual, you know, came from a very powerful, wealthy family, and yet he gradually came to be seen as a champion of the average working man and poorer people and those discriminated against in this country. And certainly he angered a lot of people in big business by his stance. Of course, a lot of interesting things you have to remember. Joseph Kennedy was in actuality a pretty big Texas oil man. So when you look at a lot of what people call the usual suspects, and believe me, my associate and I, Tom Hartman, did for several years, you know, you start seeing, yeah, there were problems with J. Edgar Hoover, and problems is a mild understatement. I interviewed the FBI agent who was the intermediary between J. Edgar Hoover and Bobby Kennedy, and that's got to be one of the most thankless jobs in the entire world. And there were certainly many problems and even hatred between Bobby Kennedy and LBJ. But we kept finding that even though those things existed then, and they exist between political figures now, I mean, the fighting in Congress just last week shows that, those just didn't explain what happened and why. And so we kept looking and kept looking. And then we eventually found that the key to uncovering what really happened was in the hands of Bobby Kennedy.
Bobby Kennedy, I'll explain that.
Well, you probably heard the old saying, I think this was popular in the early 90s, if you find out who controls, you know, the cover-up, you'll find out who controlled the conspiracy.
True.
And yet, as we started finding more and more, Bobby Kennedy seemed to be in the middle of things that had to be kept secret and were covered up. And Bobby Kennedy certainly didn't kill his own brother. So that made no sense. And even other people doing parts of the cover-up, like U.S. military and these generals, they were people close to Bobby. They were acting for Bobby. Bobby Kennedy named one of his sons after Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Maxwell Taylor, Max Kennedy. So we thought, well, but these shadowy generals, they couldn't have killed JFK, or surely Bobby would not have been so close to them. And they seemed to be acting for Bobby. So we eventually started talking to people close to John and Bobby Kennedy, who had never spoken before or had never spoken about these events before, and we learned a truly incredible story, stranger than any fiction, and yet it's backed up by thousands of pages of documents in the National Archives. This day, anybody can go look at these, most of them declassified only in the past 10 years, many of the most important declassified because of the efforts of myself and others working behind the scenes to help the JFK Assassinations Record Review Board learn about and then declassify these documents. And what they reveal is just incredible. But it confirms everything that our sources close to the Kennedys were telling us starting in the late 80s and early 90s, before these documents were ever released.
And does it include Lamar, the CIA?
Certainly there is some CIA involvement, but in many ways it's not what a lot of people would think, because the CIA was certainly trying to kill a head of state at the time, but the head of state they were most concerned about killing, and this is from the director on down, wasn't JFK, but it was Fidel Castro.
Do you believe that Castro was Kennedy's biggest undoing in this quest to overthrow him?
Well, it was a dual thing, and it really had a lot more to do with Bobby Kennedy than JFK, because Bobby Kennedy was waging two wars in the summer and fall of 1963. One was certainly against Fidel Castro,
right.
Secret war, and this book has elements of that on a scale that you can barely imagine, that are amply documented, that have never been revealed. Yet at the same time, and it's often forgotten today, Bobby Kennedy was waging the biggest war America has ever seen against organized crime and the mafia and several ruthless godfathers in particular. And the tragedy is the secret coup plan that I'm about to tell you about was infiltrated by three of those mafia godfathers who were able to turn parts of it against JFK himself. But it all boils down, it all comes back, and the best place to start is with this incredible secret plan that the Kennedys, not just the CIA, but the Kennedys had to stage a coup against Castro and invade Cuba on December 1st, 1963.
Okay, obviously after the fiasco at the Bay of Pigs, they never let that rest then. They continued to plan an overthrow, right?
That's true, and that led to this thing called Operation Mongoose in 1962 that got nowhere except perhaps provoking the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what people don't realize is the Cuban Missile Crisis never truly ended. There's a myth that's in most history books that says JFK promised not to invade Cuba in return for ending the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
That's only part of the story, as Dean Rusk, JFK's Secretary of State, told me. And he was really the first of the Kennedy associates that I got to speak with personally. He had retired to the University of Georgia, not far from where I live. And I was very surprised when he said, no, there was no pledge not to invade Cuba. And I was like, well, I've heard that a million times. You still hear it today all the time. He said, no.
Exactly.
He said there was a condition on that. And then when documents started coming out literally the next year, this has been proven by two historians at the National Security Archive, a private group at George Washington University. They've written an entire book on it. All the documents confirm exactly what I'm about to say, which is what Rusk told me. He said, no. And you can even go back and look at newspapers at the time. Dean Rusk told me that, no, part of the deal between JFK and Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of Russia, was for UN inspections for weapons of mass nuclear destruction. In other words, the UN had to be able to go into Cuba to verify the weapons of mass destruction were gone. Castro never allowed that. He refused to allow that.
Okay, so the deal really wasn't done.
Never took effect. So, to use another contemporary phrase, John and Bobby Kennedy needed to look at, I guess you'd call it, for lack of a better term, a preemptive invasion. However, very different from what's going on in Iraq. I want to stress that. While the Kennedys knew, and it's clear from all their private meetings, and many of these documents are even available completely to read online, they knew the general public and some countries. I mean, Russia knew that the deal wasn't final, but the Kennedys kind of tried to paper that over, and as long as things take their current favorable course. But, in the private meetings, they knew they had to do something about Castro. But they couldn't just flat out invade Cuba because that could provoke a response from the Soviets. And you couldn't be 100% sure all the missiles were gone. That's what Republican conservatives were saying even then. So Kennedy was starting to get beaten up in the press by his potential rivals in the 1964 elections. Richard Nixon, Nelson Rockefeller, Barry Goldwater, who constantly said, JFK isn't doing enough, missiles might be back in Cuba. So JFK felt, and Bobby, that they had to do something before those 1964 elections, kicked
something,
off. In
something grand, because he was not a slam dunk for reelection, was he?
Oh, no, especially in the South because of his civil rights stance, which ironically resulted in two motorcades, one of which most people will hear about for the first time today, that he literally risked his life knowingly. So he couldn't just do nothing about Cuba. And yet he couldn't flat out just invade. And the Kennedys had problems with these CIA attempts with the mafia to just shoot Castro. They had problems with that since 1959, before JFK was even elected. JFK made his reputation as a crime-busting senator in these crime hearings where he confronted Jimmy Hoffa and these folks.
Exactly.
So, but even then, he and Bobby were prevented from talking to a couple of godfathers because they were working for the mafia, even in 1959, to try and kill Castro for the CIA. So that that had led to problems, and the CIA had promised Bobby they wouldn't do that again. And so, and the Kennedys didn't just want to put another dictator. They did want to bring democracy and freedom to Cuba. So they came up with an incredible plan by working with just a handful of trusted Cuban exiles, one of whom was a key source for us, and his name is all the time in Bobby Kennedy's personal phone records, Harry Enrique Ruiz Williams. He wanted us to call him Harry Williams. And using him and a contact very high in the Cuban government, They came up with the plan in the summer and fall of 63 to basically stage a palace coup against Castro, where Castro would be killed. However, neither the Cuban exiles working for JFK nor the coup leader in Cuba would take credit. The blame would be placed on a, for lack of a better term, patsy, as Harry Williams told us. Someone would go on the ground to take the blame. And if you think about it, if it appeared that Fidel Castro had been killed by a Russian sympathizer, for instance, and there were a lot of news stories at the time about conflicts between Castro and the Russians because he was trying to play the Russians and the Chinese against each other. If it looked like a Russian sympathizer had killed Castro, okay, that would make the Cuban people turn against the Russian troops remaining in Cuba. And the new leader of Cuba, the Cuban official that had the respect of a large part of the Cuban population, he would be able to say, well, look, these Cuban exiles, they're going to help me. They all fought against Batista, but we need some U.S. help to keep the Russians from taking over. So he would literally, this new provisional government that would include a few conservative exiles, but also very liberal exiles, and the current Cuban. Many current Cuban officials, they would literally invite the U.S. forces in. Now, the United States had a specially trained group of a few hundred Cuban exile American veterans of the Bay of Pigs ready at Fort Benning to be the first troops. So it wouldn't be a lot of crew cut, you know, all white Marines. It would multiracial, speak Spanish, but the Kennedys were prepared, and we have the plans, and we show some of them in the book, and we quote them, and they're in the National Archives. You know, it might not work out.
And this
plan
was December 1st, 63.
Right.
It was going to happen a week or so after he was assassinated, had he not been killed.
10 days. The countdown, the 10-day countdown was literally beginning on November 27th.
Well, then somebody somewhere, Lamar, double-crossed him, I guess.
Well, what happened was, remember I said Bobby Kennedy had two wars going at the same time.
All right.
Okay, against Fidel Castro and against the mafia in general, and three mob families in particular, were bearing the brunt of his prosecutorial efforts. And those were the Chicago mafia family, a prominent member of which was named Johnny Roselli, the Chicago mafia's man in Las Vegas and Hollywood, hung with Frank Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe, pretty much an unofficial member of the Rat Pack out there. Also targeted was Santo Trafficante, the mafia godfather of Tampa, Florida, his operations, which included a large heroin network as well, and Carlos Marcello, the Louisiana mob boss, the godfather of New Orleans, whose territory included East Texas and Dallas. Those three godfathers, all of whom had worked for the CIA on the CIA mafia plots at different times, and they were... Several were working in the summer and fall of 63 with the CIA. I don't feel the CIA, some people in it, really trusted Kennedy. And so they continued to work with the mafia as kind of a backup plan. Okay,
they wanted Castro out. They wanted their casinos back in. So you would think they would endorse this plan, or did they not?
Well, the problem was this. They were under such intense pressure from the Kennedys. Carlos Marcello of New Orleans, his trial started the day before the first attempt these gentlemen made to assassinate JFK, and it only ended on November 22nd because he had bribed a juror. He made sure it ended the day JFK died, because that way Carlos Marcello had a big celebration planned for that afternoon, ostensibly to celebrate his acquittal, to celebrate JFK's death. But these men, Marcello was not a citizen, and neither was Johnny Roselli. They were also subject to deportation. Marcello had been briefly deported in 61 and had to tramp through the jungles of Central America and snuck his way back in. And so these guys were under such pressure, they couldn't take the chance. They couldn't wait another month, let alone to the 64 election. They
All right,
had
stay
to
with
Bobby
us on
Kennedy,
that, Lamar.
Pressure on them now.
All right, well, let's talk about that more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed. With our guest, Lamar Waldron, we're going to take some of your calls as well tonight. The West of the Rockies, number 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line is 818-501-4721. The wildcard line is 501-4109, of course. And what Lamar has told us so far is John and Bobby Kennedy had a plan, a coup, the invasion of Cuba on December 1st, 1963. That plan was infiltrated by three godfathers, Johnny Roselli, Santo Trefecani, and Carlos Marcello. So we'll have him pick up that story from there in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Lamar Waldron, our guest, his book, Ultimate Sacrifice. We're going to take your calls in just a moment. Lamar, so we've got this situation then with John and Bobby planning a coup invasion of Cuba on December 1st, 1963. Now, who brings in, who solicits the help of Roselli, Trafficante, and Marcello? Does Bobby Kennedy do that?
Oh, no, no, no. The Kennedys had worked very hard to exclude the mafia and exiles that would work with the mafia from their coup plan. The Kennedys
didn't want them involved. Okay, they didn't want the mob involved at all.
And if the coup had been successful, it would have been a democratic, you know, government in Cuba that would not be, happy with the mafia at all. So even if the coup had happened, but the mafia needed that coup to cover their assassination of JFK, because what happened was, as we've documented in the book, most of your listeners are just hearing about this coup plan for the very first time tonight.
Yeah, including me.
And yet, in government documents and public sources, anybody can see 12 associates of Roselli, Trafficante, and Marcello, 12 associates of the Godfathers learned about the coup plan, and get this, 6 associates of the Godfathers actually worked on the coup plan. Now, they were able to do that because they were, in many cases, also working for the CIA in some capacity, or working on these Castro plots. It was kind of a backup the CIA had. So that gave them the access. And we have incredible smoking gun documents, for instance, where Roselli's Chicago Mafia family pays one of Bobby's Cuban exile leaders, Tony Verona, who's passed away, so I can name him, $200,000 in August of 1963. And this was a trusted aide of John and Bobby Kennedy, Cuban exile. Roselli's mafia family gives him $200,000. And then just a couple of weeks later, he brings a Trafficante killer and drug smuggler into the operation. And they're talking about the need to remove certain obstacles. So it's just amazing. And these are CIA documents anybody can get. So unfortunately, you know, the CIA was asleep at the switch. You know, when that bribe occurred, they probably thought, well, we're working with the mafia, we're working with this Cuban exile, big deal. Well, it was a very big deal.
Tell me about the first two assassination attempts before the successful one in Dallas, and then what, if anything, then did Lee Harvey Oswald have to do with it?
Sure.
But the first one was in Chicago. What happened? Obviously, it didn't occur. What went wrong?
Well, things were going pretty well a week before, because as Pierre Salinger, a name you probably remember.
Oh, sure. I was his press secretary.
Right. JFK's press secretary told us, and we report in the book and document for the first time, Jack Ruby, who was from Chicago originally for years and still had many friends and family there, was in Chicago 1 week before the Chicago attempt and got $7,000 from a Hoffa associate linked to Roselli and Trafficante. And in other words, Jack Ruby probably would have had the same role in Chicago as he wound up having in Dallas. And yet the Secret Service and the police, and we've talked to a Chicago Secret Service agent about this, and we've documented this more extensively than anyone else ever has before, found out about that the four men were going to try to shoot JFK. They looked for the four men, couldn't get them into custody. The motorcade time was approaching. People were starting to line the motorcade route. It was a big motorcade. Mayor Daley was a big ally of JFK, and there was a big football game they were all going to watch. It was a big deal. But because these four men were still at large, JFK had to cancel that motorcade, cancel his entire trip.
Okay.
And poor Pierre Salinger got stuck with coming up with first one excuse and then another to cover it up.
So that's the first one. Then in Tampa, what did
they
plan to do?
And this has never been in any book before. The Warren Commission got rumors of the Chicago attempt, They didn't even get rumors of the Tampa attempt. All the investigations, the Church Committee investigation into the CIA in the mid-70s, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the Senate Watergate Committee that secretly interviewed Johnny Roselli, this was withheld. The Tampa assassination attempt on November the 18th was withheld from all of them, and it was kept secret at the time by John and Bobby Kennedy. Now, this truly is a profile in courage on JFK's part. He had to give a speech that night in Miami, Florida, that had some lines the CIA had helped him write, mm-hmm. directed to the leader of the coup in Cuba, you know, basically saying that JFK was behind this and would stand behind him. You know,
and this would be almost like JFK. A trigger to get going, yeah.
Exactly. So JFK was warned, and I've talked to the Tampa chief of police at the time and other officials about this. JFK was warned that they had word of at least two assailants who planned to shoot JFK with a rifle from a building. And this Tampa motorcade had four stops on it, the longest of his presidency in America. And so he was told about that and frankly advised not to continue. I mean, it would just be too dangerous. But he knew that the coup date was set December 1st, had to do something. And so he decided to go ahead with the motorcade in spite of the danger. And we report so many parallels in the book for the first time between the Tampa attempt and the attempt in Dallas, even between the Patsy in Tampa and the Patsy in Dallas. They had a dozen parallels in their lives at the same time.
It was a different Patsy?
Sure.
Okay.
And yet it was a young man in his early 20s connected to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Left
same
his wife around the same time Oswald left his wife, moved to a different city around the same time.
Oh,
it's just
my.
Incredible. So, but Traficante had a man in law enforcement in the Tampa area, tipped him off, so the attempt was not made. So that left, so you've had one attempt in the home of Roselli's mafia family, one in Traficante's hometown. And so next, it was Dallas. And we have incredible new information about Dallas in the book and the eyewitness account of two of JFK's closest aides from the car, from the limo, right behind JFK. They actually saw the shots from the grassy knoll. One of them was still alive.
I've never heard that before. This is riveting. This is the first time I've heard this.
Well, and yet this people can also find that they don't have to take our word for this. They can look. I'm sure you remember Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House in the 1980s.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
His autobiography is in most large libraries in America. People should go check it out tomorrow because JFK's aides, Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell, told Tip O'Neill the same thing, and he put it in his autobiography in the mid-'80s. So it's out there. Now, what David Powers told my co-author, Tom Hartman, and at the time Dave Powers told Tom this, Dave Powers was the head of the JFK Presidential Library in Boston. And he really shocked Tom when he told him this. Tom, by the way, was sitting in a rocking chair, and Dave Powers pointed out, you know, that's one of JFK's rocking chairs from the Oval Office. And Tom was stunned because most people that work with the Kennedys don't like to talk about the assassination, but Tom had just asked him about the coup plan. Powers had not been told about the coup plan. It was that secret. Even Secretary of State Dean Rusk wasn't told about it until the day after JFK died. It was incredibly secret, which is how it's remained hidden all this time.
Sure.
But Powers had been told when he had to testify to the Warren Commission that for the good of the country, that was the phrase, for the good of the country, he and Kenneth O'Donnell could not say that they had only seen and heard the shots from the grassy knoll. So if you go back and look at their testimony, they kind of waffle, and mm-hmm. it's obvious they're under tremendous pressure, but they kind of waffle. Now, we do also point out in the book, for the first time, the man who took Powers' affidavit was now Senator Arlen Specter.
Okay, but surely the mob then didn't rely strictly on Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas.
Well, no, I mean, the mob is carried out, as Bobby Kennedy said, you know, probably 1,000, especially the Chicago Mafia, 1,000 hits with no convictions, you know. And so the Mafia would use trusted professionals that they could count on who had done this repeatedly and gotten away with it. So men like, there are many reports, Johnny Roselli was in Dallas. One report, he flew from Tampa after that attempt to Dallas, Charles Nicoletti, several reports about him, Chicago hitman, famous for his hit car he was caught in a year earlier that had special compartments for guns, radio equipment, even a place an assassin could hide. And we all know about the grassy knoll and the picket fence. Behind that picket fence was a parking lot. None of those cars were ever searched.
Why didn't Bobby Kennedy go after these people after the assassination of his brother, the president?
Well, in many ways he did. He kept trying to prosecute Carlos Marcello. The closest ally of Marcello in Trafficante was Jimmy Hoffa. He certainly kept trying to prosecute Jimmy Hoffa. But Bobby's own words provide the answer to what you just said. Bobby gave some testimony before Congress in September 1963 in which he said it was almost impossible to successfully prosecute a top mafia godfather for anything, for the smallest crime, let alone something like a murder, even a routine hit. They would insulate themselves so well. I don't think Roselli would have been in Dallas if not for the fact that the first two attempts had failed. So Bobby knew that prosecuting these top godfathers was almost impossible, especially because they had infiltrated the secret coup plan and had used parts of that in the JFK assassination attempt. So it was impossible to fully expose what they did without exposing the coup plan and literally risking World War III.
Had Bobby backed off on the mob, would Kennedy have been alive? John?
It does appear that way because the mafia had bribed their way into the coup plan, so they might have seen the possibility of sometime being able to set back up in Cuba. So, but you know, just like JFK, now imagine you're JFK. You survived that Tampa motorcade. You know the assailants from Chicago and Tampa are still out there, have
yes.
never been caught or identified. You've got this motorcade in Dallas. Now, it's been known for years that the morning of that motorcade, JFK talked on two occasions
about
how
easy
it would be for someone to shoot him.
Yep.
Now we know why. And yet he continued that. So he didn't back off in spite of the danger, and neither did Bobby Kennedy. Though in retrospect, I think, Bobby did make a comment to an associate once that, he thought it would be himself the mafia would go after, not his brother.
Very interesting theory. Let's take some calls. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Ryan in Chico.
Hello, Ryan. Go ahead. Lamar's waiting for your question.
Sure.
I am very interested in the topic tonight. I just want to say that yesterday would have been Bobby Kennedy's 80th birthday.
Wow. I hadn't actually counted that up, but you're right, because he had had a birthday right before the assassination.
Yeah, I guess C-SPAN had some kind of get-together in D.C., I guess, but I never saw it. I'd like to see it, though. But my question tonight is, so are you saying that it was completely a mob plot to assassinate the president?
Well, Bobby Kennedy told his told close associates it was Carlos Marcello who killed his brother. Bobby's associates, actually several of them, continued to look into aspects of the assassination. And they told us, of course, the House Select Committee on Assassinations added Santo Trafficante to that. Other Kennedy associates added Johnny Roselli. So it was like those three people working together. Now, they bribed and used whoever they could. We are very careful. We don't want to make wild accusations, but you will see the names of some lower level, I would perhaps call mid-level CIA people in the book, and we outline the evidence against them. And people can make up their own minds. That the highest level person in the CIA that we feel was probably knowingly involved was a gentleman by the name of David Morales, who was the chief of operations at the huge Miami CIA station, the largest CIA station in the world, by the way, even though it was in America. And he was very close to Johnny Roselli. Now, there's a chance Morales drank heavily, was very close to Roselli. Roselli is a very sharp man. Roselli got the best of Howard Hughes in a casino deal a few years after the assassination. So it's possible Roselli manipulated this David Morales, but, there's a strong probability Morales, who was not politically sophisticated, might have felt they could both kill JFK and still get the coup plan. Yeah, I was going to say, people in Washington, like CIA Director John McCone or Richard Helms, they would have known that the odds of LBJ continuing, Bobby Kennedy's coup plan were zilch if JFK were killed. And indeed, JFK was literally killed the day the countdown was beginning, and their close Cuban aide, Harry Ruiz Williams, was going into Cuba the next day to await the coup. So, if anybody wanted Castro overthrown, they killed Kennedy at exactly the wrong time. So we do not give the CIA a free pass, but we're very careful and we marshal our evidence and, encourage people to make their own judgments.
1975, I was one of the last newsmen to talk to Jimmy Hoffa before he disappeared. I walked him to his car. I invited him on as a guest on our television show.
This is great stuff. I had not heard this before.
Yeah, I walk him to his car, and he said, George, I'm going to come back and get that union presidency. I said, well, how are you going to do it, Jimmy? He says, I'm just going to say some things to get me elected again. And he got in his car, and that was the last I ever saw of him. And not too much later, he went to the Marcus Red Fox, and he disappeared forever. Up until today, I always thought what he wanted to do was talk about the mob and his relationship with the mob and that he had gone clean. But I kept saying to myself, no, he's not going to do that and re-implicate himself. I'm wondering now if he was going to say something about Kennedy's assassination, even though he couldn't stand Kennedy's guts.
Well, I think you're probably on the right track. And the book puts the death of Jimmy Hoffa that occurred short time after the death of, and I say death, murder, of Sam Giancana. And then, of course, Johnny Roselli is shot and stuffed in an oil drum. We've all seen these long, lists of hundreds of mysterious deaths in relation to the JFK assassination, and many of those don't pan out. We focus very closely on the mafia associates, and it's only about a dozen or so, but they're just literally, they start dropping like flies in the mid-70s, starting with Sam Giancana and ending with the death of David Morales. So it's just uncanny. There was a congressional investigator, Gayton Fonzie, who would track down these people, and then they would literally die or commit suicide, the day before he would talk to them. And we feel that it's just a very close, cause and effect relationship. By the way, the one man connected to the deaths of Sam Giancana, the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, and Johnny Roselli is Florida mob boss Santo Traficante.
Isn't that interesting? Now, do you think LBJ had anything to do with any of this?
Not really, because remember, most people think that because the assassination happened in Texas. Well, It was originally supposed to happen in Chicago, and if not there, in Tampa, Florida.
Yeah.
LBJ by that time was much more a citizen of Washington, D.C., And frankly, Marcello's organization, it's been reported, had been giving LBJ money for years. So, if needed, the mafia would have favors they could call in or scandals they could threaten to expose. But there was no reason to do that. So LBJ, by the way, was totally left out of this coup plan. He was not even told about it. He had to spend the weekend after the assassination being brought up to speed about it. So, in other words, there was really no reason for LBJ to be involved, in addition to which LBJ was not liked among the Dallas establishment. LBJ and his wife were attacked in the finest hotel in Dallas during the 1960 campaign because LBJ's stance on civil rights. So LBJ was not, in thick with the city fathers of Dallas, so to speak.
Very good. Lamar, the book, Ultimate Sacrifice, where do you get it?
You can get it Amazon, hopefully Borders, Barnes & Noble, just about anywhere. And people can go to our website, which is ultimatesacrificethebook.com. And we have excerpts, and we're going to be posting a lot of the documents. And I encourage people to, look at the book, stand in the bookstore and read it if you want.
Well, let me tell you, it's very, very, very well done. Lamar, we've got to run. Thank you for your theory. We've still got two more to go on Coast to Coast AM.